Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. Today, we have Zach Goldstein. He's joining the program today, and we're going to be discussing some very interesting topics with Zach. He's been on our program several times before. Zach, once again, thanks for joining the Socialist Insight.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Zach, how's everything been since the last time we spoke up there in the Bay Area?
Great. The last time we spoke, we were talking about gearing up for May Day, May 1st, International Workers' Day, as its full title is, and it was great. I went down to Occupy Oakland, 14th and Broadway, where I saw a lot of old familiar faces, so it's always nice to reunite with some great comrades. The police presence wasn't that entirely large, so it was certainly nice not to have fascists show up. Then I went over to Occupy San Francisco, and that's sort of where the major event was happening in the Bay Area. And we were over there at the Embarcadero, and it was just great. You know, it was a lot of solidarity, and it was fantastic.
How was Occupy? How was it? How is it doing up there in the Bay Area now? Because we can see with the police presence, the crackdown by the government, even though Obama said that he was supportive of people exercising their rights, we see that there's been a major crackdown on anything that's related to Occupy across the nation. Especially you saw that right there in Oakland where you live at. What have you seen yourself in regards to the Occupy movement and any type of strength that's still there in the movement in the Bay Area?
Well, Occupy Oakland has taken on many different forms since its birth a few years back. And the current incarnation that it's really taken is that every month, every few weeks, there is a forum held in either Berkeley or Oakland, somewhere in the East Bay. And comrades come together and they talk about the issues that are facing their community, whether it is, you know, foreclosures by the banks, whether it's businesses, you know, coming in and destroying what's left of small businesses, corporate entities taking them over, homeless people, the homeless rate is rising, government programs being cut on a local level. So it's just this form is a way to express discontent on the local and state level as well. We have a lot of representatives coming from numerous places to talk about their own experiences and what they've been facing. And so Occupy Oakland has served as sort of a platform for people to come in and express their discontent with the current status quo.
I see. Well, we're going to get into a little bit more about what is going on there in the Bay Area in just a few, as we get on into the program. But today what we're going to be discussing what young people in particular need to know about capitalism. Because in my opinion, I think, and I can see that capitalism has been a complete failure. The models of capitalism that has been used over the millennium in every situation, if we go back 2,000-3,000 years with the Romans, with the Greeks, in various societies with the Egyptians, in every society where capitalism has been a model, it has been a complete failure. But very often, Zach, when I speak with young people, they ask, you know, where is socialism working today? My question is to you, Zach, where is capitalism working today? Because we see capitalism is just in complete chaos from one end of the globe to the other. But where is it working?
Yeah, capitalism has taken us as far as society can sustain it. Capitalism itself is a boom and bust cycle. My grandfather actually used to own a small shop in Brooklyn, and one of the expressions that he said was there were 7 years of a boom and 7 years of a bust. And I think that quote's very interesting, because why would you play a game where for 7 years you roll the high life, and then for the next 7 years you're down in the slums? I mean, when you take on the youth perspective when it comes to capitalism, we have a student debt crisis in the United States and across the world.
Right.
In the United States here alone, the student debt has surpassed $1 trillion, and this was almost a half a year or so back.
It's $1.1 trillion.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's ridiculous. How can we expect students, how can we expect young adults who have just graduated from college or from graduate school, how can we expect them to leave and go out into society and contribute their own self-worth, their own ability to contribute to society, when they are tied down to debt, and that they're going to be paying off their debt for either a great majority of their lives or sometimes for the rest of their lives? They'll be chained down by this ball of debt. So we've created this sort of economy where it's based off of students who are trying to contribute to society that they can't because they have debt, so they have to constantly be working towards lowering the debt by buying more things, and it becomes a consumer-based economy, and it's almost engulfing its own self. It's cannibalizing itself.
We can see it's not working with education. Yeah, we can see it's definitely not working with education, especially when you see how students have been strapped with massive debts, and we just see absolutely no relief in sight. Now, when you look at the student debt, right now, as I mentioned, it's $1.1 trillion, and it's the largest it's ever been in the history of this country or the history of the world. What has really caused this type of escalation of debt? Because we have seen a lot of the state colleges and the federal, where colleges across the country, we have been seeing a continuation of where it's been only just escalation. But in recent years, why have we seen such an escalation of debt like that for students? One of the reasons is because we can see that the various states, they're not funding the universities, and the federal government has cut back as well because of other priorities that they have, such as war. But what are some of the other things that you can see has been such an escalation?
Well, you just mentioned probably the major upset is that this country spends more on the military-industrial complex and putting money into banksters and into Congress people, then into the hands of the students and the teachers and the people who actually want to learn and need to learn. We have an economy that focuses more on the war machine than on the mind and the brain itself. And we also have we have had a noticeable change in universities and in colleges across the country slowly being privatized. And when
right.
you have a college or a university or a school where its primary focus is no longer to teach students the necessary knowledge, but to have a for-profit system where their
right.
only goal is to achieve more money, is to accumulate more wealth instead of the wealth of some physical material, but the wealth of knowledge, that's been disregarded altogether.
What I see, Zach, is that education has just become like a commodity, something just to sell, and it's not a focus on education anymore. It's more like, how can we make this profitable? Is that essentially what we're saying?
Exactly. I couldn't put it better myself. It is a commodity, straight up.
When it comes to student debt, obviously, as I mentioned, it's $1.1 trillion and still climbing. Many students, debt that they have accumulated $30,000, $35,000, like anywhere from 7-10 years ago, they still, with the interest, they owe more than what they owed when they initially had accumulated that debt. And it's almost like a credit card. If you pay just what's required, you'll never finish paying on it. You'd be paying on it for a lifetime. How should that be dealt with when it comes to students? Because as we can see in a capitalist society, they don't have any intentions for you to pay it off. They want you to pay it off for the rest of your life. But how should that be dealt with by governments? Because there are ways that the federal government and the state government can deal with this crisis.
To put it simply, cancel all student debt. And the way to go about that.
Well, that's the best way that I see.
Yeah, it's because we shouldn't be tied down. We shouldn't be. I feel like having debt is almost as if it's a punishment for even going to higher education. We should be.
It is.
If we can't encourage people to go to higher education because of all this debt, then how are we expected to accumulate more knowledge? And not only to, you know, bolster our own community, but ourselves as individuals. It's ridiculous.
Why hasn't Congress or the president, why haven't they moved in that direction?
Well, right now, Congress, as it has been for, well, the greatest majority of our country, we've been particularly a two-party system, and unfortunately, these two parties have drifted closer and closer together and further to the right.
Right.
And with that happening, the ideas coming out of Congress, and never mind the gridlock that has been happening since it almost seems like the beginning of this country's history, is that these two political parties, or one could look at it as one party with two names or two factions, is that they constantly proposing ideas that are very extremely similar to one another, just with different names. It may be a different journey, but it's the same end game. And these two end games are, they focus more on, you know, free markets and this idea about how if you just pick yourself up by your bootstraps, everything will be okay, which is economically untrue. If you work, you're, you know, part of my French, but if you work your ass off for your entire life, there's no guarantee that you're going to, you know, have success.
Oh, no.
I don't think that's the intent or whatever.
I don't think that's the intent. You know, that all that crapola that is talked about, you know, if you work hard and get an education, work hard, it's going to pay off. But when we see you work hard, you know, I mean, you get a good education, you can't work hard because you can't find a job.
Exactly.
Yes. So there's something wrong with that thinking that, you know, it's going to pay off. And unfortunately, many young people, they fall into that trap, not understanding that in many cases it's just going to lead to debt and there's not going to be any promise for any jobs. We're going to get into we're going to talk a little bit more about education, but we want to look at the broader picture. Today we have Zach Goldstein. He's joining our program today. And what Zach is discussing is what we're talking about today is what young people need to know about capitalism, because it's a lot of things people believe, young people are taught to believe in the system, and it doesn't work. Zach, just moving on, I want to ask, does capitalism benefit working people other than creating a permanent working class?
No, it isn't. I said this early in the program in that throughout the course of human history, there have been economic and political systems that have pushed along humanity with the negative and positive effects coming out of it. Capitalism has pushed humanity only to a certain point. And right now, and we've seen this in the past few decades leading up to this moment, capitalism cannot offer us anything else. We have gotten to its point where we have gotten all we can, and we have to move on. We have to move forward into a new system of economics as well as politics.
Are we even moving in that direction?
I You know, I would like to think so. I would like to think that people are becoming more aware, and this is extremely true. When you have in Europe, you have anti-austerity movements. You
right.
have political parties that that are leftist and that are radical and that are socialist, that once only had one or two seats in their respective parliaments, now taking up majorities. You have people in across the Arab world rising up to cast off the shackles of American-backed dictators. And here in the United States, you have people in the Occupy movement and other very similar movements coming out and saying, we have had enough of this status quo, a status quo
right.
where the place that we spend the most of our time, which is the workplace, is extremely undemocratic, and our own voices don't matter. They have no worth. And so we want a workplace that is equal and democratic, and that's what the essence of socialism is, and that's what it means to replace capitalism. And
right.
how it will, there are many different theories. I, of course, would like there to be a more peaceful solution, but we need to look at alternatives nonetheless.
Zach, also staying with this in regards to labor, because we can see that capitalism only creates a permanent working class, and if you ever see a situation, and throughout time, through even throughout your lifetime, you have seen where people have been able to rise up with the short-term benefits of capitalism, but in many cases they're crushed and they lose their homes, they lose their credit, they lose their jobs, but it's only just been short-term and short-lived. But explain to our listeners, Zach, how does the capitalist, how do they benefit from labor? Because we can see that the way they exploit labor, but how do they benefit from labor, the capitalists?
Well, it's a lot of complex manipulation. They create all these. When you take the stock market, for example, it's essentially the world's largest sort of gambling operation. You create all these strange, manipulative economic sort of incentives and ideas and concepts like derivatives and all of these nonsensical tactics that sort of confuse the rest of society. And what they do is they create all this jargon, and then they essentially accumulate wealth while they are essentially stealing other people's wealth while they aren't looking. There's a free market system where, and the free market system is essentially only benefits the capitalists and the elitists, because it helps divide the working class.
One of the things I see, Zach, is very often, like big corporations, when they look at how they need to increase their profits, sometimes they lay off anywhere from 5,000 to 20,000 workers, but they still require the same amount of production from the people that are still there, and they look at labor, they look at an individual as far as how much labor can they get out of the individual at the cheapest cost. I was listening to Forbes one day on television, and he was saying, well, if you can get people to work for $1 an hour, if they work for it, he say, well, that's fine and good, you know? I mean, $1 an hour. So had no compassion that people need to pay for their expenses and their families, but he only looked at labor as a means of how can a corporation or business increase their profit or their bottom line.
Exactly. It's an extremely corrosive system that we have. And, you know, another major issue in terms of as labor is the unemployment factor. And
uh-huh.
what I think would be a major way of how to combat unemployment would be to cut every single worker's hours in half. Then the rest, that other half of their work, would be hired by someone who's just as capable. So you have two people doing the rest of that particular job. And opponents may say, well, then they have less time to work. What would they do? Then they would have more time to to enjoy themselves, more time to live and experience life. Because
well,
you don't
I can relate
want
to that.
Comfortable being in the workplace, working to some retirement that may or may not ever even happen or exist.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's call it the modified 8-hour workday, but that's what it should be. David McReynolds, and I know you as well, advocated in your respective presidential campaigns, advocated for the amount of hours that you work in a week to be vastly reduced. That is something that I think would obviously appeal to the working class. We don't want to be constantly slaving away for a future that may not happen.
And one other thing, Zach, I want to just mention, when you look at labor, right, explain to our listeners also how, when you look at the capitalists, how they search the globe for markets where they can get cheap labor.
So, yeah, this is sort of the
like,
major
for instance,
of-
like India, when they go to Taiwan, China, Korea, South Korea, they search the globe for cheap labor. And the impact that it has on working people in this country.
Yeah, the sort of major tenet of modern-day globalization is that borders that create sovereign independent states no longer mean anything.
Right.
While I am an internationalist at heart, there's almost a downside in the sense that, sure, you know, we are one planet, but then the corruption spreads across borders and goes into governments and goes into the workplaces. So if when our minimum wages are slowly rising, which, you know, at a snail's pace, but when they are and when work benefits slowly but surely come into our own economy here in the United States, corporate interests want to relocate their workforce or their means of producing said material to other countries where the work laws and the work ethics are of a much lower standard. For example, as you mentioned, you have South Korea, you have China, all these places across Southeast Asia where the work ethic is extremely low and unregulated by their respective governments. So
right.
That's why that, and thus, so corporations take their resources and profit somewhere else, and then you have joblessness across this country exploding. A great example would be in Michigan and Flint and in Detroit, where all the cars are being moved out of the country, out of the city, into all these other areas across the world, and you're leaving homelessness and joblessness behind.
Well, that was a good point that you brought up about unregulated, because organized labor and having regulations for labor, for industry rather, having regulations, it's almost an enemy to the capitalists, because they want to make certain the least amount of regulations and no unions, no organized labor. That's more of a benefit to the capitalists and the wealthiest in any society.
Exactly.
Zach, just moving on. Like I said, when we look at capitalism and what I'm hoping to do with this program today, many of the myths that people have in regards to how capitalism is beneficial to working people and socialism, they think it's an enemy. Actually, socialism is more to the benefit of working people as opposed to what we see in a capitalist economy. China right now has emerged as a major economic superpower. How, in your, this is only in your opinion, it's only in your opinion, how has that improved the living standards of the people in China as opposed to the any type of benefits it has been to working people?
China has an extremely interesting history when it comes to flirting with economic systems. It's flirted with, you know, feudalism. It's flirted with communism. It's flirted with capitalism. There's almost a strange sort of hybrid between the government, the state, and sort of the for-profit capitalist market that they have. Their economic system is called socialism with Chinese characteristics. And it's a little confusing because they use a lot of words that mean other things. For instance, there is the Communist Party of China, which I think has more in common with the Republican National Committee than with any other socialist party here in the United States. China's sort of flirtation with capitalism over the past several decades has been uplifting only a certain amount of people out of poverty. That is true. However, when it comes to on a grand scale, it's failed. You only have people in large industrial cities coming out of poverty, but only ever so much, where they're barely into the middle class in China. And the rest of the country is still miserably stuck in poverty. And so they have this sort of state capitalist system of economics, and where the government itself acts kind of as if it's a corporation. And obviously corporations in of themselves are extremely dictatorial, extremely authoritarian in the sense that if the CEO says something, you have to do it, no questions asked. The complete opposite of what a government should be, which is free, open, and democratic. And so it's flirted with this, you know, state capitalist system. And so, as you know, going back to the original question, there's only been a certain amount of people to rise out of poverty, but the massive amounts of people who are still in China, still living in China, are not even considered amongst the middle class. Consider the working class.
You know, one of the things I find very interesting how the big banks and the big industrialists and multinational corporations and how the capitalists, how they operate, they take a country such as a communist country, communist China, and what they do is they use that as a means of going into that country to offer benefits of how it can create jobs in an industrialized society. And they have done that with by using 1.3 billion people, the cheap labor there, and they have brought a capitalist system in a communist country. I mean, Zach, it doesn't get any – I mean, when you talk about some of the ends and the means that capitalism will go to exploit labor, they will go to the ends of the earth. What's with that?
Well, yeah, you would, and it's also I would also have to say, to add on, at least speaking from my own perception of these particular economic systems, is that China, when I refer to China as being a communist state, I would say communism in the sense of being communism with a capital C, state communism, a la sort of a Soviet-esque sort of model. But even in that regard, capitalism knows no bounds and no borders.
Right.
It knows wherever
the
money is.
Exactly. They don't have any borders when it comes to profit, because what they have done is they still have a communist government, and they have a capitalist economy. So what they have done is they put together both so that they can go in and tap into the resources of cheap labor. And people don't realize that it has not really benefited the working people in that country. Many people don't understand that in many cases, several families are living in one roof. In per household, it's usually an average of one car for every seven persons that are living in a household. One car for every seven people. If I look at my household and most of the households across this country, you probably have one car, at least one car for every other person, not for every seven people. And that's what we have in that country. And also how they have exploited the labor in that country, where in many cases you have people working extensive hours where they're getting paid anywhere from $2 to $2.50 an hour, working with all sorts of outrageous hours and not being compensated properly. But it's exploitation. And then you have big corporations here. They're reaping the profits, and they're the people living in that country, whether it's that country or the other countries that I mentioned, they're barely just living above poverty level. And people don't even understand how, even in this country, how so many people are now being driven toward poverty because of the cheap labor. But it's very cyclical. I can't even say the word. It's evolving. It's cyclical, where it goes from one country to the other because the capitalists are constantly searching the globe for cheap labor. Zach, I'm going to move on here a little bit, looking at the U.S., the debt that we have here in this country, because presently the U.S. government has a national debt of $16.8 trillion. Most people can't even comprehend those numbers. And also, there's another $14 trillion in hidden debt. In other words, we have over $30 trillion in debt. Now, when we look at television, they talk about the $16 trillion, and now people, it's almost like going into your dentist, and they put the Novocaine in your mouth, and then you don't feel what's happening. So we have almost become numb to $16 trillion. But here we are. We're like $30 trillion in debt. People don't understand, and they need to understand, Zach, that this country, we're pumping the Federal Reserve, the feds, are pumping $85 billion every month into this economy. So when you look at the stock market, and they say the stock market is doing great, well, it's doing great because they're doing it on a U.S. credit card. Because this is debt that is being created for working class people. But, Zach, how does this type of debt, how does it jeopardize the future of our children yet to be born?
Well, there's when it comes to debt, there's several things we, the United States, can do as the world's form of superpower. One of the things that, you know, I and the Socialist Party USA advocate for when it comes to debt is that we demand the cancelization of third world debt. We demand that the United States pays off its debt to the United Nations. So these are two major factors that I think that we need to really focus on. Now, yeah, you know, having debt is a serious issue, but we also need to realize that, like the stock market and like just economics in general, it's almost as if it's all, I want to say it's imaginary in the sense that, yes, the debt is real and there's a serious issue because we are constantly spending more.
It's real. Like, you get your credit card and you put money on it, you know, you got to pay it back. So it's very real.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that, you know, in order to tackle this problem, what we can do is to get more revenue, to get more money, is that we look at programs that we are spending large amounts of money in that we don't need.
We look at the
military-industrial complex.
Right.
And we can cut the military-industrial complex by 50% and then by 75% and constantly cut it back down to pre-9/11 levels, because, quite frankly, we're not fighting land wars anymore. We're not fighting the traditional-style wars that our grandfathers and great-grandfathers fought. it's quite frankly ridiculous that we're spending so much on the most state-of-the-art aircraft carrier when no one else's Navy can even come close to the might that we have with our Navy. It's ridiculous. So if we cut back money in that sense, we can easily get more money back into our own pockets and pay down this debt.
Well, where I see that myself, Zach, where it's jeopardize the future of our of young people yet to be born, if people really think about how much debt has already been accumulated, and I'm talking about the hidden debt and also this, you know, the trillions of dollars that we see every time we look at television or read the newspaper, I mean, that's equivalent to every person when the day that you're born, every senior, every person you see walking around the streets, wherever they're at, everyone is already in debt for $90,000. That's the real amount that you owe just for being born to pay off the debt. But this is future debt that we're looking at for our kids, that when you look at countries across the country, across the world, when you see them talking about austerity, we're talking about future austerity for many of our young people, people that are yet to be born. Because the capitalists, when they look at what is owed, they generally don't forgive that debt. They still say, well, if you don't pay it, it's still owed like 100 years from now or 200 years from now. The debt stays there. So, but what I see is future debt that's being created, and much of that is being created by this administration and previous administrations within the last 10 years, where we have seen that the debt is almost triple. But, Zach, in 2007 and 2008, President Obama, he promised that he would cut military and defense spending and bring our troops home. Now, we can already see that, you know, that was a broken promise that he made. And he said that this would be done within his first year in office. Zach, I'm just, you know, your opinion on this. How has his broken promises that he made to the American people, how has it proven to be costly for many of our young people and our seniors? Now, we have already discussed how it's been costly for many of our young people, because now we see debt, student debt is going through the roof because the federal government is not helping as far as to cut much of that cost. They're making loans that students will be responsible for paying for the rest of their lives. But how has the broken promises that Barack Obama made in 2007 and even months before he took office in 2008, how has that those broken promises affected many of the people, including our young and seniors in this country?
Well, it's created a disillusionment in the system. It's created a falsehood that the system that we currently have in place can create systemic change that the working class needs. It's the idea that Barack Obama was supposed to be, you know, a progressive, someone who was, you know, the furthest left that the Democratic Party could produce, someone who would be, radical in changing the system, was a falsehood. One of the major tenets, one of the major failures of his first year was, closing Guantanamo Bay in Cuba.
He said he would do that within his first year also.
Yeah, and it's still open. Not only is it still open, but now we have massive problems in terms of prisoners. I believe it's the 166 people who are still in Guantanamo Bay. Over half of them are now on a hunger strike here.
And Zach, on that note, I just wanted to mention, I was reading an article, this was around 2 weeks ago, that each person that is there at Guantanamo that is costing the government $860,000 a year to house each prisoner there. $860,000 per year.
Yeah, that's taxpayers' money. That's you and I and everyone else. We're paying to prop up this one of the most undemocratic institutions that have ever existed in the past century and then some. It flies in the face that what this country is supposed to represent, the supposed concept of us being the land of the free and the home of the brave, or some other BS. This is completely the antithesis of what we're supposed to represent. And going back to Obama, he was completely a facade. In his 2008 and in his 2012 campaigns, one of his top contributors to his campaign was Goldman Sachs and a long list of other corporate entities that he helped to bail out. He didn't bail out the people. He didn't bail out the working class who were hit the hardest by the Great Recession. No, he bailed out the people who had, who had to give up one extra private jet. And so the idea that Obama was supposed to change something in a short amount of time was ridiculous.
So essentially we see that trickle down crap doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
You bail out the big banks and the big financial institutions, and nothing's really going to trickle down. Well, what trickles down, you probably don't want it on you anyway. So,
yeah, exactly.
Right. Let's say, for instance, if the president had done what he had promised, I mean, what would have been some of the immediate benefits, beyond saving lives, because in these wars that we have had over there in the Middle East, I mean, it's been very costly, but beyond the lives that we have been losing, what would have been some of the immediate benefits as far as if we had ended these wars and brought up troops home? Obviously, we have already talked about one, making educational more affordable. But what are some of the more immediate benefits that the president, if he had kept his promises, that he could have done to make things better in this society?
Well, if you end the wars immediately, you pull out your troops, you pull out your military presence.
And one of the things I see is our infrastructure. I mean, the whole infrastructure, the whole country is falling apart, and we definitely could just do that alone to create millions of jobs across the country. But what are some of the other things that he could have done?
Exactly. You take the military strength that we have, you relocate them back here, and you create an entire new jobs program that has the military focusing its efforts here at home in creating new roads, creating new bridges, creating new public transportations and public centers. And that's how you get the unemployment of all these veterans down, extremely down.
One of the other things I see, Zach, right up there in your area in Fremont, California, Toyota and General Motors, they close a plant there because they're looking for the globe where they can build cheaper trucks. Ford has closed their plants here in the country because they're trying to find cheaper labor. But you have had many jobs that have gone outside of the country and outside of this state where both of us are located. But for even transportation, that could have been, you talk about the troops coming home, just peacetime jobs, repairing the highways, helping the manufacture of automobiles, and even various types of industry where it could help to clean the environment. But I mean, Zach, the list goes on and on and on. What could be done with the monies that we're wasting over there in that war? Presently, since Obama took office, he has taken this country into well over $4 trillion in debt. And when he got into office, he started out with $780 billion right from the top. And then he used the additional monies that President Bush had, it's been going on and on nonstop since he took office. But do you see any other thing? I mean, I probably could go on all day, the various jobs that could have been created. and even for many of the technical institutions where people could learn trades and like that and prepare people for jobs that you would be creating. These are other things that could have been done as well. We should hold President Obama accountable for this. I don't think he should get off the hook that easy. What do you think?
Well, I think there's this strange sort of misconception about what the American populace expects, in the sense that people believe that, you know, the President of the United States has the ability, has the ability to control the economy or the value of certain materials, such as gas prices. And what I want is not where one person in such a high executive power can do that, but where people can themselves control the economy, where they economically plan out for the next X amount of years what can happen.
You're talking about X amount of years. I'm asking you what could the president done immediately, because right now the country is in a crisis management position. So we're talking about a crisis. What could have been done? Because people, obviously, they didn't elect the socialist candidates. They elected the capitalist candidate. They elected the individual that represents Wall Street and, as you mentioned, Goldman Sachs. So what could he have done immediately? Because there's certain things he could have done immediately. Now, if we look at the long term, what a socialist could do, that could be like maybe 20, 30, 50 years or 100 years from now before we have a socialist that's right there in Washington, D.C., and also in the Capitol building where we have them as legislators. But that's not happening today, and it's like a ship that's sinking. We're sinking as a ship, and we need some immediate results, not long-term. And long-term, I agree with you, Zach. We need that too.
Well, I think, you know, there could be a myriad of possibilities of what President Obama could have done within his first term, or even now in his second term as president. And I think that, you know, it's important that while what he could have done, you know, there are countless possibilities. What we need to do as socialists, our duty for right now, in the meantime, is to critique, but not only critique, because I think we're very well at critiquing the capitalist system, is then to present an alternative. If we came into the position that Barack Obama did in 2008 and 2009 when he was inaugurated, was that we would have stopped both wars immediately. We would have pulled out all of our troops. We would have instantly shut down all 900-plus military bases across the globe. Then what we would have done is we would have come back here. We would have had these military officers come back, help them get jobs by building roads, by building parks, by building all these public institutions, create a logical map to a socialized medicine system of healthcare, where corporate interests and private for-profit institutions are a thing of the past. You would create a workplace where there are no longer CEOs or board of directors, but the workers themselves, the ones who actually produce the wealth and the materials that are needed for that wealth. They are the ones who are in control, and they do it through, and by that process, it's through a democratic process.
One of the things I find very interesting, Zach, when you mention healthcare, I was reading something that I was reading in the media, and I'm not certain who exactly published it, but obviously Obama decided to put healthcare in the hands of big HMOs and the various pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies. And if he had created a single-payer healthcare system where people would have been able, instead of giving their monies to the various big corporate America, that it could have created well over 1.5 million jobs just right there alone in the medical field. And obviously those are generally good paying jobs where you have other jobs that are created as a result of that. But that was a good point, Zach, that you brought up, that even in the medical field. Zach, we have just a few more minutes here. Actually, we have like around another 6 minutes or so, and then I want you to just get some contact information. Zach, I have to really appreciate you coming on. We have Zach Goldstein. He's joining our program today. He came on very short notice. I had a spot, a guest that was supposed to have been on, wasn't able to. It was a cancellation. And then within the last 24 hours, Zach said, I'll make myself available. And, Zach, I know I can always rely on you because you're constantly reading. You keep up on issues that are going on within the Socialist Party USA, other socialist organizations. And how old are you now, Zach, 19 or 20?
I'm 20 years old.
20 years old. For 20 years old, you have more knowledge about what socialism is about than people that have been involved in it for over a decade. But, Zach, I just want to get your explanation of something that's within the platform of the Socialist Party USA and many of the socialist organizations. But as a socialist, as socialists, as you say, we believe education is a human right, okay? Why is it a human right?
Well, knowledge itself should be free. You should have free access to knowledge. It is the duty of every single human being on this planet to learn. And what they do with that knowledge is, well, their own business, and they certainly have a right to it. But the access to that knowledge should be free. And what they do with it should be up to them. It shouldn't be institutionalized or privatized. It shouldn't be bought out. It shouldn't be paid for. We should teach our kids not only, we have a problem with teaching our kids not only what to think, but we should be teaching our kids how to think. That's even more important. We should teach them what to question, how to question. And so education should be free because knowledge should be free. The access to knowledge should be free.
And one of the other things I see, Zach, when you look at education and you look at every other species on this planet, and we can see whether it's in the jungles or in the forest, but every species, you can see the learning process, whether it's in a pack or through the parents. You can see that the education of their young is at no cost, and they're doing it so that they can be able to survive, where they can eat and be able to take care of themselves and be able to add to that community of whatever species it is. And here as humans, we use it as a means by how we can create it as a commodity. And this is one of the reasons why we believe that it's a human right. This is something as human beings that we should be able to enjoy everything that we should be able to get out of this society for learning, because what it is, it's an investment right back in to the communities and the country that we live in.
We are the only species on this planet that pays to live on this planet. That's ridiculous. The concept is outrageous.
Zach, the last thing I want to just cover, and if you can take probably a couple minutes just to elaborate on this, should the federal government, even right now, they're talking about all these austerity measures, and the thing is, as I mentioned earlier, the government is investing hundreds of billions of dollars into corporate America, and then they want to put the brakes on this society for any benefits for working people. But when we talk about our youth, because many of them are going to be looking for jobs, should the federal government invest in a summer's job program where it could put the millions of students across this country, give them jobs throughout the summer vacation? Even though we're looking at, they're talking about how much in debt the country is in, but I think it's worthwhile for our future and to make certain that our students can be productive citizens. What is your opinion on that?
Well, one of the problems with the New Deal is that it was only temporary. Yeah, we should have a Workers' Progress Administration, but this time have it be a permanent institution, have it be run by workers themselves. Yes, we should invest in summertime job opportunities for those in school so they can help support not only themselves and their families, but their community. When you have a working class that has stable jobs, they will then go out into the economy and buy materials. When they buy materials, then they help the economy flow and stabilize and grow even further. If you have money, you will spend money. And in a sense, then you will make money because you are making the economy grow. It's almost quite simple, really. So, yeah, we should give people the opportunity to get jobs. And we should do that in the form, a realistic way, would to have a WPA, would have a other New Deal-esque type programs, and whether it's for, you know, those who are, you know, painting murals as artists,
uh-huh.
or those producing art through film, or those who are on the side of technology and medicine, or building public institutions,
right.
We should have these programs available already for workers who want to get into the workforce. Get a job, and expand and help their own communities.
And Zach, I have around 45 more seconds. What is your contact information and the contact information for the Socialist Party of the Bay Area?
Well, you can reach me on Twitter at Zach L. Goldstein. You can follow me for constant updates on Facebook. You have the Bay Area Socialist. The Bay Area Socialists. You can go on to facebook.com/Bay Area Socialists. Also, go on to the Socialist Party USA's website at socialistparty-usa.net and register with the Socialist Party because we need your help in the fight against the capitalist system and for peace and democracy here and abroad.
Well, Zach, again, I appreciate you joining the program. Once again, we have Zach Goldstein. He joined us today. Really short notice. Again, Zach, thanks for joining the program. And next week we will have Alan Mackey. He comes on the show every other week and discussing various topics of interest. So be certain to join us once again next week on the Socialist Insight. Once again, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to having you to join us next week. Good night. Thanks again, Zach.
No problem.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to the Research Rabbit Hole Radio Show with Cynthia Hamill. Tonight, we go further into the rabbit hole with the topic on 9/11 with today's guest, Duane Dietz. Duane has a whole boatload of information here. I'm going to try to say this really slow where I get it all out. Dwayne Dietz has a master's in science and physics, as well as a master's in science and engineering. He is the former director of aerospace projects with NASA Dryden Flight Research Center. Before this appointment, he served as a director, research engineering division at Dryden, and then was a recipient of the NASA Exceptional Service Award and the Presidential Meritorious Rank Award in the Senior Executive Service in 1988. He was selected presenter of the Wright Brothers Lectureship in Aeronautics. He is a distinguished speaking engagement sponsored by the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics in 1986. And he's actually included in Who's Who in Science and Engineering, 1993 to the present. He's also the former chairman of Aerospace Control and Guidance Systems Committee of the Society of Automotive Engineers. He is a former member of AIAA Committee on Society and Aerospace Technology, and he has had a 37-year NASA career. So welcome, Dwayne. I'm so glad to have you on the show.
Good to be on the show, Cynthia.
Yeah, I had no idea you had all this lined up. We've been having coffee together for 2 years in this 9/11 group, and man, this is a whole mouthful to spit out. I can't believe you've got all this stuff. That's really cool.
Well, that comes from sticking around for a while, I guess.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. Dwayne's one of these people, he's very, very quiet, but when he talks, everybody listens, and there's probably a reason for that, because he's so smart and he's got a lot to say. So I can't wait to see what you're going to say on this Flight 93. I've heard you a couple of times on this topic, and it was so impressive, I just had to bring you on the show. So what can you tell us about United Flight 93 of the day of 9/11?
Well, I think, first of all, I think Flight 93 is of the kind of problems that occurred with all of the four flights. And so I think on this call we'll just restrict ourselves to Flight 93 because there's more than enough to talk about there.
Okay.
And the way I thought it would be good to break it up is talk some about the problems with the calls from the passengers to their loved ones. And there were a lot of calls on Flight 93, and I'm just going to talk about a couple of them to give you a feeling for the problems. And then I'll talk about some evidence that there may have actually been two Flight 93s, two different airplanes that were representing themselves as United Flight 93. And then the final thing I'll talk about is the types of, let's say, stonewalling by the authorities, placing barriers to attempts to get information on what actually happened. So that has been ongoing ever since 2001. So that's kind of the big picture. So let me go back to the couple of problematic phone calls. The first one I'll talk about is Todd Bremer's call, and I pick him because he's the one that is maybe the most notable phone call. He's the one that is known for the "Let's roll" statement before apparently the passengers took command and took over the airplane. Interestingly, Todd Bremer spent most of his time, on the order of 15 minutes, talking to a telephone operator, a GTA telephone person by the name of Lisa Jefferson. And it's unusual in that she attempted to put him through to his wife, who the FBI says he originally tried to contact. And he didn't want to be put through to her. He didn't want to upset her, he said.
Wow.
That's just a little bit mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is he was remarkably calm. It's almost like this traumatic situation, which he had to be thinking it may be ending his life. Yet he just was unusually calm. He actually talked to two people, according to the records, at the phone company. The first operator he talked to, just briefly, and then she put him to, I think, maybe her supervisor, and this other person took the call from there. But we don't know anything about this first person other than her name. There was no interview immediately following that the public knows about. The FBI didn't get around to interviewing until about a year later. That's very, very unusual, since they seem to be interviewing everyone associated with these calls the first day. Now, so one possibility is that they did interview her, and they just kept whatever she had to say classified, and we just don't know about it. But going back to Lisa Jefferson, she, in describing the times that she was talking to him, actually testifies to talking to him beyond the time when the plane supposedly crashed. Now, she didn't spell that out precisely, but the times that she gave, and when she said it, probably the call went on for 15 minutes, in her own mind it went to a time period that was past the crash itself.
Wow.
Another thing, this is actually Verizon Wireless records, show that there were 19 outgoing calls made from his cell phone after the alleged crash.
Whoa.
Which, yeah.
Wow. No way.
Now, like, what does that mean? Does it mean that he wasn't actually on the airplane when he was calling? Does it mean someone else was impersonating him?
Whoa.
And not even in the airplane? All these kind of things were possibilities. And, of course, the third thing is that the plane didn't actually crash. So we don't really know. And then finally, and this is back to the phrase, let's roll. That phrase wasn't actually in the record where the FBI interviewed Lisa Jefferson, the person he talked to, on the day of the call. So that was a phrase that came along later. And then it became kind of the phrase. This is what we know about that whole flight, was that phrase. So that also makes the call extremely problematic and makes you wonder whether it was anything close to what the officials say it was.
Wow.
Now, the other call that I want to talk about is Mark Bingham. A lot of people that have looked into this are kind of taken away by the fact that when he was put on the line with his mom, he called a house of, I think, a sister or something like that, and it turned out his mom was there at the house, and they said, well, let us put you on with her. So he says, hi, Mom, I'm Mark Bingham. Now, how many people use their first and last name when they're talking to their mom?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that's a giveaway right there. Oh, my gosh.
Right.
Wow.
But the other thing, and maybe this is really, I mean, it could be that he just has a habit of giving his name as first and last name. Who knows? But the next thing is quite difficult to deal with. And that is, his mom says that she asked him, after he said there's hijackers or the plane's been hijacked, she asked him to describe the hijackers. And he kind of avoided the question. And then she asked him again, tell me about the hijackers. And he just did not answer that. Well, why wouldn't he answer it? He actually was up in first class. He was in the fourth row. And he should have one of the best seats to see what the hijackers look like. And yet he was avoiding that, almost like he had been told to not describe the hijackers. So that's perplexing. But it is, it's also a pattern. There's almost none of the calls. In fact, on Flight 93, none of the calls described the hijackers. They didn't describe what language they were using when they spoke over the loudspeaker
system.
Yeah. And Were they talking in Arabic or were they talking in English? Did they have an accent? All those kind of things. None of the callers even mentioned that topic.
Wow.
So that's another problematic thing. And there's probably a dozen people that made calls from Flight 93 that have problematic issues with them. And we could spend the whole hour just going through all of them. And whereas I think this is enough to give you an idea that there's something was fishy about the whole thing.
Yes. Yeah. As with almost every detail of 9/11, if you really start looking at it, you know, it's been amazing just to see how did they get away with this? I mean, what were they thinking, you know?
Right. Yeah. And let me just mention one other thing about the flights, and this has to do about the phone calls. This really pertains to all four airplanes. And that is the question on whether the calls were made on cell phones, as many of the callers said they were doing,
right,
or whether they're using the satellite phones, usually referred to as seatback phones.
Correct, yeah.
Well, here's what happened. There were some 9/11 truth people that have done some technical studies and basically demonstrated that cell phones of that era could not work above about 5,000 feet altitude. They weren't designed to, and in the experiments that were run, they didn't work. And apparently the FBI realized that that was the case, and when it got around to the only time that this went on record, and that was the Massawi trial, where the FBI had to testify on it. In their testimony, mm-hmm. there were only two phone calls out of all four airplanes that were attributed to cell phone calls. And so one of those was on Flight 93. But it turns out that those calls were made below 5,000 foot altitude, according to whatever records that they were
using. Do they look credible to you, Dwayne, or what do you think?
They don't look credible. It's like, well, in the case of Flight 93, if you believe the flight data recording records, when the plane got below 5,000 feet, it was in a nosedive, upside down, and about ready to crash. Now, for that to be the time that the cell phone call actually goes through, that kind of is beyond reason.
Right, yeah, whoa.
And here's the other thing. At least in Boeing 757s, in that year, and Flight 93 was a Boeing 757, the satellite phones apparently had been deactivated. We have more proof of that for the American Airlines flight, which is the one associated with the Pentagon. And I'm not sure whether we have similar confirmation from the airline, but they basically were being removed from airline service because I think they were not economical. So that casts a whole big question on whether these calls actually came from any of the airplanes, and in particular Flight 93.
Correct. And isn't there even some type of electromagnetic functioning that happens? Like, say, remember, like if you're in an elevator and you're trying to, dial out on your cell phone, sometimes you can't even dial out of an elevator. And looks like from a jet there would be a lot more metal and a lot more, you know, of a blockage where it would be more difficult to reach even.
Well, there is
a
certainly
cell phone
more
power.
There's more insulation. I'm not sure whether it's the metal part. The jets, they're pressurized, so they have to have a cabin altitude that is quite different than the actual altitude. And all of that can contribute to the signals not getting through the skin of the airplane as well. But again, they would also be going faster. And if you're going faster, it's more difficult to keep connected with the different cell phone towers. And that's why it's just it wasn't designed to work at those altitudes or those speeds, and it probably didn't work on that day, and it probably wasn't even a factor in how the events actually went off.
Okay.
So anyway, that's all I really want to talk about on the phone calls, but they certainly are part of the whole story.
Correct. Is there anything else that you wanted to mention on this?
Well, I think I'll just go ahead and go to the next thing, which is the possibility that there were two airplanes representing themselves as Flight 93. Because what happens is the only thing that is directly connected with an airplane is what we refer to as its tail number or its registration number. And then they get assigned to particular airline flights for whatever the airline wants to assign its airplanes. So
yes,
it's quite possible.
This is the speech that you gave for our 9/11 group, correct?
Yeah, it's a big part
of
that.
Yeah, this is really important. I hope my audience is listening up because you've got some really important things to say with this, because I think it's uncanny all the things that they possibly arranged in order to pull this off. This is really important. So I'm glad that you're on and can explain this to everyone.
Okay, so one thing I talked about in that talk, which was probably about a year ago, is there is a communication system similar to email. The acronym is ACARS, Aviation Communication Addressing and Recording System, I think, something like that. And it allows the airlines, their dispatchers, to communicate with their airplanes. So in this case, there was a United dispatcher that was sending messages to all of the airplanes. Well, the messages get routed to a ground station that is automatically determined to be, let's say, closest to the airplane in flight. It doesn't have to be the closest, but it's the one that's got the strongest signal. And so there's an overall system to manage which transmitting station actually delivers the message to the airplane. And that gives you a clue as to where the airplane is, because the message includes a label that says what ground station was actually used. And that turns out to be important because it gives an idea where the airplane actually was. The other thing that happens is when the signal gets to the airplane, there is a system acknowledgement. The system does it. It's like a device, electronic device that's on the airplane. As soon as it receives the signal, it sends a signal back that says, I received it and what time. And that becomes part of the record as well.
Okay.
And so by studying the records with all of that additional information in them, which are printed out and they're available and they have been obtained, actually they were obtained by the 9/11 Commission, and so the records were in those records, in those files, and we 9/11 Truth people were able to get access to those 9/11 Commission records. They're not actually the report or even in the report, but they're backup information that's available. Well, what we found is that, I'll just jump to the chase here and say there is evidence that Flight 93, according to that system, was still in flight and continuing westward after the time when we are officially told that the plane crashed.
Whoa. Wow. Now, how can they prove that, Duane?
Well, I mean, the question is, how can we prove it?
Mm-hmm.
We've got the records that were briefed to the FBI by the people from United Airlines who were the experts, the manager of the unit, the management unit at United Airlines is the one who testified to the FBI. So we've got what he testified. We've got that in writing, although there's redaction, so you don't have all of the information, but you got enough to figure out what's going on. And, of course, we're not in trial. It's not like a prosecutor said, okay, witness number three, tell us about these ACARS records. We don't have that legal formality. We just have the records that were briefed to the FBI. And we can read them and see what they say. So we have that degree of information. And when we have questions about it, when things don't make sense, and a number of 9/11 truth people have then submitted additional questions either to the FBI or to United, they've tried to talk to United Airlines people. Well, in general, we don't get a useful response. We get stonewalling. We get the reasons why they're not going to respond to us. So they don't explain anything. They just leave these very puzzling, conflicting information without any answers. We can't go any further than that.
Right. This seems to be a consecutive pattern through all of 9/11. They're just not answering anybody's questions whatsoever.
That's right. And so that happened here. Now, it is quite possible that that set of information may have been tracking a different airplane that was labeled United Flight 93 from what the air traffic control were tracking. If there were two airplanes that were identifying themselves as United 93, well, it's quite possible that these different ways of monitoring the information would lock onto different airplanes, just maybe by accident. And so that's what we see is conflicting information depending on whether you're looking at what the air traffic control thought was happening or what these ACAR, I'll just call it ACARS for the acronym, what that information showed. And it's very possible that there were, in fact, two airplanes flying.
That's what I remember from your speech in the San Diego 9/11 group, and that was the most impressive information when you were able to say that there were two planes with the exact same call letters that intersected each other possibly,
yeah.
And one flew to one destination and the other one flew to the other destination. So can you kind of go over that? I thought that was really impressive.
Right. So if that's the general thing that happened, there's a couple let's say if you narrow in or you bore in on particular situations came up where that may have been what was causing the confusion. So in one case, there was a light airplane, a Cessna, that was flying at about 7,000 foot altitude, and air traffic control asked him if he could visually identify this United airplane that was descending through about 8,000 or 7,000 feet altitude. And he picked it out, and he actually had someone with him. They were doing a photography mission, mapping, it was in Pennsylvania. Anyway, mapping the fields. And so his camera person spotted the airplane and he confirmed it. So they had two sets of eyes on an airplane that was passing through 7,000 feet. Well, it turned out at almost the precise same time, the radar, it's referred to as the primary radar, that was tracking this flight lost contact with the airplane.
Wow.
Well, we think the reason it lost contact is the airplane was below 4,000 feet. At 4,000 feet, there can be a radar hole. Basically, they'd be down to the point where maybe there's a hill or a mountain between where the airplane is and where the radar site is. And that would be an explanation why suddenly radar was lost. So if radar was lost for that reason, that means that the airplane actually was 4,000 feet or below instead of where it would, had just been sighted at 7,000 foot altitude. And then, like a minute later, there comes a message that it is at 7,000 feet and it's setting a new flight plan going towards, I think it was Washington, D.C., at 7,000 feet. So just in a very short period of time, within a minute or so, maybe a minute to three, the airplane is either at 7,000 feet or at 4,000 feet, or possibly there are two airplanes. That's where you, if there was actually two airplanes that had the same call letters and everything, that would be an explanation to this very confusing set of information.
This is really interesting. It becomes almost like the Shakespearean plot, you know, like the love triangle or something like that, where who would guess that somebody would pull this off? But it definitely is leaning in that direction when you hear all this, you know? Unbelievable what happens with this.
Right. And then I guess the third thing that fits into this overall pattern is there's an independent government agency called the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. And one of their tasks is to have all these airline numbers. So it's the way they get information like the average delay for flights coming out of a certain airport. What's the average delay from their scheduled departure time? Did they actually depart? So when an airplane departs, it actually sends a signal that is recorded in this database by an independent government agency. Well, it turns out there are two departure times for United Flight 93 on that day.
Whoa. Yeah, that's and how close were the times?
I think it was like 20 minutes apart from each other, on that order. Might have been more. But there's never an explanation. When people ask, well, what about that, they don't get an answer. So it's another thing that kind of fits maybe the overall set of data that is pointing to the fact that there actually were two airplanes. And maybe one of them had passengers on it and maybe one of them didn't. I mean, you don't know whether there was some sort of a carefully planned transition thing that would end up fooling air traffic control. And we don't know any of that.
Yeah, what an orchestration, too, to have pulled all this off and all the planning that went into this, you know. It's unbelievable, the masterminding and everything that would have had to have taken place to even, you know, think of this. This is kind of like an unbelievable plot.
You're right.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't even seen this in the movie yet. This is kind of like one of those really weird, like, who would even guess type things, you know?
No, what you saw in a movie, at least if we're talking about Hollywood movies, is Flight 93, which was the thing that glamorized the let's roll phrase and the...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. See, that's what you get for movies that Hollywood does.
Yeah, but they were just kind of spinning off the story that came out the day of 9/11, right? They had already had the story of the heroes took down the plane, and they were just kind of spinning off that, right?
Yeah, but they probably got some help along the way, some encouragement.
No doubt, yeah. Yeah, that's probably true.
So that's kind of that topic. If you have any real questions on it, before I go to the next thing, we can.
Well, the one thing that I do have questions on, I remember from your 9/11 speech in San Diego, you said that there were two cities that these planes actually showed up. Their flight numbers or something showed up or flashed above the two cities. What were the two cities that intersected? It was Fort Stockton, maybe, or something like that, and then the other one, was it Cincinnati or something?
I'm trying to remember. Well, the overall path of the airplane kind of circled over Cleveland and then headed back towards Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay, Cleveland. Okay, I got it confused with Cincinnati. Okay.
And we, if you look at the two, I talked about these two different ways of tracking the airplane, air traffic control and ACARS. They actually agreed with each other over Cleveland. So it's as if they were maybe tracking the same airplane, but it looks like maybe one of them turned back back towards northeast, circled over Cleveland and headed back towards Pittsburgh, whereas the other one didn't turn, and it ended up over Illinois.
Okay, I see. Okay.
And we don't know where it actually ended up landing. It just ended up not getting tracked anymore. Maybe it was at a low altitude.
Okay. Yeah, so they would have had to have stayed below the radar in order to have pulled all that off.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, now then, the third thing has to do with Somerset County is kind of the county where Shanksville is. We hear about Shanksville where the plane supposedly crashed. So if you have a little broader area, Somerset County, there were a number of eyewitnesses that were on the ground and observed what they saw happening above them. And overall, which I can go in a little bit more detail on these eyewitnesses, but a very different thing happened than just a plane coming down and crashing. It was things like parts were scattered over a very broad area, several miles. It just did not look like what the official story is. There's also some of the eyewitnesses described a smaller airplane, not a 757 size airplane, but more of a executive transport kind of thing. And the FBI on these basically didn't follow up on any of them. They'd question them, and then nothing happened to it. It didn't end up in the 9/11 Commission report. It's like it didn't fit what the official story was going to be, so nothing was done with it. So you have all of these eyewitnesses on the ground that gave their stories. They were on local TV, and it just didn't go anywhere.
That's very interesting, and it seems to be consistent, again, with everything that happened that day of 9/11, how many mishaps and different, you know, crazy communication things were going on that day, just with our media sources, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Totally. That's beyond their protocol. That's like, that typically wouldn't happen in a regular news story. So something must have been masterminding behind this to have pulled all this off.
Well, one thing that did happen is it's not just the FBI who was investigating it, but other agencies as well ended up just, I call it stonewalling, but they ended up with very carefully chosen words to give them an excuse to not respond to Freedom of Information requests. And as an example, there apparently was a flight data recorder that was recovered from Flight 93. And so one of the 9/11 truther people, his name is Aidan Monahan, who did a tremendous job of submitting a lot of Freedom of Information requests across the board, having to do with the buildings, having to do with all of the different airplanes. And so one of them went to the NTSB, which is the National Transportation and Safety Board, which is the government agency that normally would investigate airplane accidents. And so they were involved in this, but they only released their information to the FBI. And they basically didn't respond other than what the FBI allowed them to do. So what happened when he requested the data file out of this flight data recorder? They responded by saying, well, the data file is in raw data, binary format, just zeros and ones. So it's not useful to anyone unless it gets converted over to engineering units. And so the NTSB came back and said, well, for us to convert it to engineering units means we would be making a new record, a new record being the thing that a Freedom of Information Act goes for. Usually a record is a document,
yes,
a written record. Well, they interpreted to say engineering units would be a different record than the one that we have. We have raw data. And we are not required to provide a different record. Engineering units is a different record. So they used that reasoning to say, therefore, we do not have to respond to you. We do not have to give you the information. And so that's just an example. It's used, that same approach was used on a lot of different things. It's almost like somewhere in the government, they were given, the different agencies were given the directive that this is the way they should respond.
I see.
To anyone trying to get this kind of information.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty telling in and of itself, Dwayne, if you really look at it. That doesn't really make sense, but I'm sure they've got some type of defense mechanism to handle all this. That's
right.
Pretty interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
okay,
what
and another
can
thing
we
I
do
want to
now
say about
with that?
Another thing that actually this Aidan Monahan has recently written a book. It's called Declassifying 9/11. It's quite good. The subtitle is A Between the Lines and Behind the Scenes Look at the September 11th Attacks. And another thing he pointed out is that the crash area around Shanksville, what anyway the government tells us is the crash area, the press was barred from that area, like 4 miles around.
Mm-hmm.
So they were not allowed at all to get in the area to actually look at it.
Wow.
So that's totally unlike any other, let's say, aircraft accident.
Yeah, it's
there's
also
never,
amazing
never been a
that
situation
they could
where the
off.
Press are absolutely not allowed to get within eyesight of the record. But that's what they did on these flights, this one in particular.
Wow. I didn't realize that. That's information within itself that should have gotten out to the public, but no one's really reported on this. The news stations are not picking the story up, obviously.
Right, right.
Wow. And how easy would it have been for them to have blocked off that entire radius? I mean, you know how reporters are. They're going to go in for the story, so they would have known a back street or a back way to get there or even somebody flying somebody in a helicopter or something to break down the blockade. Looks like somebody would have covered that story somehow.
Right, and I'm sure they tried really hard because some of the early information out before the perimeter really got set up are things like the coroner who immediately showed up saw absolutely no evidence of any bodies, no blood, no nothing, no body parts. And he finally says, there's nothing for me to do here.
Wow.
And so he leaves the area, and some of the local news media interviewed him. So that's the first indication is something's wrong here.
Yeah,
and
that's
so, of course, the press would want to get in there and really bore down on it and find out what happened. Well, what they found is they couldn't even get close. They just absolutely were barred from getting close to it.
Wow, yeah. That also seems very similar to what happened with the CBS reporting of the first eyewitness news team that was sent out there that reported on the Pentagon crash. He was saying basically there's no plane, and it's on YouTube video, so anybody can pull that up. Just pull up CBS, Pentagon 9/11 crash, and you're going to see this entire account where the reporter's out there in the remains of what appeared to be an airplane crash, or was labeled an airplane crash, but actually looked more like a missile crash. And he's basically saying there are no plane parts. There's no evidence of a plane crash whatsoever here. So it's on that video.
Right.
Unbelievable.
So anyway, those are the main points, I think, on Flight 93. It's a real mystery.
Yeah, that really is. Now, did anyone ever shoot a picture later of the plane crash area to kind of go in and defend what was said or anything? Could anyone find anything on that?
I don't know of anything that would give you a hint there actually was an airplane crash.
Something
I can't
emerged.
Really remember what finally was. What, you know, they ended up building a monument finally there, a memorial,
right.
I should say.
They did show something. Something was passing through Facebook and our activist news feeds for a while that showed a picture of four different plane crashes, and one was the alleged Flight 93 Shanksville crash, and it was compared to three other plane crashes, and they all three looked totally different. I mean, the first three were clearly, here's a plane, here's wreckage, here's debris, and then you know, United 93 was like, where's the plane? There's just a ditch here. It looks like somebody just burned the ground or something. There was no wreckage. There was no plane. So that did go through our news feed. So I don't know how to pull that up, because once it goes through the news feeds, it's gone unless you share it on your page. And I did share it, but they've been cleaning my Facebook file. They don't let me keep this huge Facebook thing that was going to be my book, you know. So they've been cleaning that out and taking out some of the better stories, I may add. You know, they're leaving up just like stuff that I posted about my, you know, family or friends or something like that. But they're taking away like the real good nuggets of the activist feeds that are coming through. Mm. So I'm hoping people are paying attention as those are coming out, because they are deleted at some point. They don't let us keep those.
I really didn't, in the talk I gave in San Diego, I spent quite a bit of time on the flight data recorder as well. I didn't mention it here. In that, there is no positive information that would prove that it's part of the airplane they say it was part of. The any kind of flight data recorder is required to have the flight number, the fleet number, and the registration number, which is the tail number, part of the record. Actually, it would be the fleet number and the tail number. Has to be in the flight data recorder. But this one and the other one that supposedly was found, which was the American 77 at the Pentagon, neither of those had these identifying numbers. They just had zeros in the locations that they were supposed to have them. So that means you don't have evidence that it even pertains at all. It would never get into a court of law, because the very first thing is you'd have to provide some sort of hard evidence that it actually came from the airplane that we're talking about. And that information is not available. It's been removed somehow or other, or it never was there. We don't know.
Wow. Yeah, this is amazing, this whole story. And it's amazing that nobody's written a book yet on this full thing, Flight 93, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. The thing is that the books that are written, and there's several of them that maybe they may be right on several topics, one of which is Flight 93. I don't know that there's one just on Flight 93. But that doesn't make any difference. The thing is that these books are very hard to distribute. You kind of have to self-publish. You don't have any kind of they're not reviewed in the mainstream media.
Okay.
So it's as if they didn't exist.
Yes, wow. Yeah, that's amazing. I'm glad we're getting the story out right now this way, because a lot of people are hearing this. We're amassing a lot of feedback on the internet as far as people who are listening, and I can tell people are starting to wake up. So I'm really glad that people are hearing our interviews. That's really good.
Mm-hmm. I think that there actually, as I think about it, there is a title. It's called Flight 93, from a questioning perspective, a 9/11 truth that is questioning what happens. There's also books that are written from the official story standpoint, making it kind of a glamorous event.
Yes, that kind of follows that movie script that we were talking about earlier, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, it looks like we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there anything else that we're needing to cover, Duane, on the Flight 93 issues?
Well, I could talk about some more of the passengers' calls, but I don't. I mean, they are just each one a problem. It's a different slant. There's almost no call that was actually recorded, but in some cases where they were recorded, we don't actually know what was said because the FBI has redacted so much that you don't know what's there, or a family member doesn't want it released. There's various things like that, so it's very difficult to get any harder information on these calls than what we've got now.
Well, while I've got you on the line, I remember the discussions that we've had within our group about the three international hearings and mm-hmm. you know, trials that they basically had outside the United States on 9/11, and you were actually at the Vancouver hearings, and I was so interested in that because you said that there was so much sabotage going involved in that, and that people actually were not privy to even recording this. There was sabotage in recording it or having any type of record of that entire conference. So that makes me extremely curious what happened there. I mean, why would they have blocked that information, and what was going on at that particular Vancouver 9/11 hearing that they did not want to get out to the public?
It's real hard to know. The Vancouver hearing was more open to a wider variety of theories about what may have happened on 9/11. And it could be that some people wanted to stick to a more narrow set of theories. For example, the possibility, I actually was a speaker on evaluating different theories pertaining to the Twin Towers destructions. And the theories I included were the more conventional controlled demolition, the official theory, which is really has no evidence backing it.
The fire, you mean? Collapsing the whole building?
Yeah, fire. Just planes and then fire causing structural damage, but no intentional planting of explosives of any sort. Another possibility is nuclear devices of some sort. Yeah, I didn't narrow in on what kind they were, but there is quite a lot of evidence that it could have either been a fusion reaction or a fission. Those are two different kind of nuclear methods, and there's actually evidence to support either one of those, which could possibly say that it was a combination of types of devices. And then the other type is directed energy, which I also talk about. So the fact that some of these theories are considered to be almost taboo within the 9/11 truth community, maybe the sabotaging came from within.
Oh, I hear you. Yeah, and it's amazing that Dr. Judy Wood has had so much resistance to her technology, especially if you start delving into the topic of chemtrails and, of course, HAARP technology, H-A-A-R-P, which people should investigate on directed energy weapons applications, mind control technologies, and all this. It has U.S. patents dating back as far as like the 1920s as far as chemtrails go. So this is not an airy-fairy technology or some type of quote-unquote conspiracy theory. This is like, this is a science that is probably at least 60 years advanced beyond what, you know, the public is aware of, but is something that definitely should be looked into, I would think, you know. So I think that, was it correct that you had at one point researched Dr. Judy Wood and her directed energy weapons applications?
Well, I looked into it, and it was, I looked into it enough to include it as one of the theories, since what I presented was looking, kind of comparing one theory and the others over a number of issues to kind of see which theory fit the set of issues that I looked at. I looked at nine different issues. I could have picked different issues, and I probably would have ended up with a different result, but it was just a matter of being as objective as I possibly could towards the evidence that we seem to have. So that was one of quite a number of, I think, quite interesting talks. But part of the sabotaging is the person who was in charge of doing all of the filming or the videotaping, videographing. Basically, all the records were destroyed somehow or other.
Oh dear! Wow.
I don't know exactly the particulars, but net result is nothing that was videotaped came out of it, and so we're left to just hit and miss on whether someone else was doing a video recording. In the case of my talk, there wasn't anyone else doing a video recording, so just don't
wow.
have it.
I would like to say for my audience to look up the information that I have included on hubpages.com on the Kuala Lumpur 9/11 hearing commission. That was a very interesting full account. There's a lot of different speakers that speak on that in Kuala Lumpur, and some very good speeches that kind of help people catch up to date on what's happened within the 9/11 truth community that's not been shared with our master and major, you know, news sources here. It's almost like all this information has been blocked. And then we also have the Toronto hearings, which is very detailed. There's some extremely good speakers that speak at that as well. And if you look at both of those, they're highly detailed. People have come in, experts have come in to basically look at every angle of 9/11, and basically a lot of it's just hogwash. None of it makes sense. So I think the public owes it to themselves to kind of do their own homework and see the story has continued way beyond 9/11 and just our anniversaries of 9/11 to include experts in their field that are all professionally exposing what they found that does not make sense with the official story of 9/11. Correct, Dwayne?
Right. In fact, there's a very good DVD of the Toronto hearings, so it's well worth it to look at the speakers, watch their talks, and then there's the written material that goes with that as well. So.
Yes, I particularly like the McQueen. Was it Graham McQueen, his speech?
Yes, uh-huh. This was on the eyewitnesses at the Twin Towers.
Yes, I thought that was fascinating, and I think it was one of the most gripping speeches that I heard, just because he had done so much research on that, and the testimonies were pretty incredible, and it's definitely worth people hearing and seeing.
I agree with that, yeah.
Well, very good. Okay, so we've got, like, now about 5 or 4 minutes to wrap this up. Duane, is there anything else that you'd like to recap with?
It's hard to think of what I might say on that. The Flight 93, as compared with the other three, were actually into buildings, if they actually were as described. Flight 93, we don't have that. We have zero evidence, nothing visual, no video records of the airplane flying in. Of course, we don't have that on the Pentagon. But on the other hand, the calls from the airplane, whether they're cell phone or airphone or out of a room somewhere, we don't know who the callers were, but it is so rich. There's a lot more callers from Flight 93 than the other airplanes.
Why can these not be, like, picked up by the major cell phone carriers? Why couldn't we find a detailed description of where this call was coming from? Because they've got that technology, you know?
Well, that's it. You know, that's interesting, because the companies, the wireless companies,
yes,
they have the triangulation from their cell towers. They will be able to tell you where the call came from.
Uh-huh.
That means that the FBI has that information. That information hasn't been released.
Whoa.
And I would think it probably isn't released because it doesn't support the official story. That would be my guess.
That's very telling right there. That's really, really sketchy, don't you think?
Yeah, right.
Whoa. I just can't believe that. I can't believe that they'd get away with that. You know, it looks like the public would have, you know, commanded, give us this evidence. Tell us where these planes were. They've got the information, you know. Wow, I just can't believe that.
Well, the public is not demanding it because the media is not encouraging it. The media isn't pursuing it. The public isn't going to do it in a big way unless the media kind of leads that effort. And since the media isn't doing it, it's left to a small percentage of the public, the 9/11 truth people in this case, who take it upon themselves to go out and see what they can find. But that's a small percentage of the public, so it just doesn't get visibility.
Well, we're working on that, and that's kind of what this radio show is about. We're trying to get the word out, you know. I do feel like it's taking root. I see people's posts on Facebook, so I know people are listening, and I see advertisements, and I see movies, and I know that this news is getting out there. I can just tell. So I'm not giving up. I'm still plugging away with it. And, you know, my producer, Ruth Ann, is on board. We're all plugging away trying to get the word out. So I really do appreciate you, Duane, coming on and speaking. Is there anything else you'd like to say the last 2 minutes?
I want to mention another book that just came out very recently. Let's see if I can get the title. It's called Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11. And the subtitle is Counterfeiting Evidence. The author's name is Elias Davidson. I understand he's an Icelandic person.
Okay.
But it is along the same theme, counterfeiting evidence, and that's looks like what happened on Flight 93. That's just a big example of that. He actually goes into a dozen of the passengers on Flight 93 and really digs into that. So I'll just leave that with you.
Okay, wow. I can't wait to check that book out. Thank you so much, Duane Dietz. It's been a pleasure to have you on my show, and thank you so much. I appreciate all your information.
Sure. Enjoy doing it.
Okay, great. Take care, Duane. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Always.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.